This is Audible.
Tanglewood Publishing presents Ashen Winter by Mike Mullen. Read by Mike Mullen. Chapter 1. 10 months had passed since I'd last seen the sun. The rich blue of that final August sky was fading from my memory. Colors are slippery. If you cover your eyes and try to remember blue, you see black. Now we had a yellowish-gray sky, dark as a heavily overcast day. Darla said Yellowstone's eruption had hurled billions of tons of fine ash and sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, and it might be years before the sky returned to normal. I said the dim light was depressing. In April, we prayed for a break in the winter, a warm spell to melt the 4-foot blanket of snow smothering my uncle's farm. But April was colder than March, May colder still. In June, the mercury in the Farmall tractor thermometer hanging outside the kitchen window fell below zero and stayed there. Every day we watched the thin red line try to claw its way to zero. Every day it failed. No more snow fell, but none melted either. We'd run out of chapstick months before. For a while, we all wore my Aunt Carolyn's lipstick, but now that was gone, too, and our lips were cracked and bloody from the dry winter air. The storms that had followed the eruption had spent their fury, and drought clutched us in its dry fist. My world was frozen, desiccated, and dead. I was always cold, cold as I worked during the day, cutting wood, hauling snow to melt for water, or digging for the corn buried under the snow and ash. Cold when I went to bed, cold when I got up in the morning, despite Darla snuggled against my side. Before the volcano, if you'd told me that I'd be sleeping every night beside a girl I loved, I'd have said you were crazy. Mom would have filleted me and served the choice bits as hors d'oeuvres if I'd ever so much as closed the door with a girl in my room. Not that any girls would have wanted to be alone with me. Before I met Darla, I'd had a total of one real girlfriend, and she dumped me before we'd done much more than make out. I still didn't think of myself as having a girlfriend. That word was too trivial for what Darla meant to me. When I met her on the road last year, I was bleeding, starving, and ready to give up. Ready to die. Without each other, we wouldn't have escaped from Iowa, from the devastation and chaos Yellowstone had caused. Now, I wouldn't want to survive, to endure the desperate labor and daily frostbite, without Darla. But if Mom showed up now, fillet knife in hand, to scold me for sleeping next to Darla, I'd hug her and savor every second of the scolding. She and Dad had left my uncle's farm near Warren, Illinois, leaving my younger sister Rebecca there with my aunt and uncle. Darla and I had arrived on the farm in early October, 5 weeks after my parents had left to look for me. No one had seen or heard from them since. And Mom wouldn't find me sleeping alone with Darla anyway. In April, the falling temperature had forced us to abandon the upstairs bedrooms at my uncle's. Now, Darla and I slept in a clump with my aunt, uncle, two cousins, and sister on the living room floor near the fire. A night spent spooning with your girlfriend isn't nearly so exciting when your uncle is curled up against your other side. We got the idea to sleep together from the ducks. They'd been doing it all winter. But a few days after we started imitating them, one of the ducks on the outside of their pile in the barn froze to death. So we cleared everything out of the main floor guest room, adjacent to the living room, and started keeping the ducks and goats inside at night. Our sleep was occasionally interrupted by quacks and bleats. And I never got used to the stench of the billies. Male goats stink worse than skunks. "Earth to Alex," Darla said, drawing my attention back to the barn where we were working. "Would the former planet known as Alex please come in?" "Former planet?" I asked. "Yeah, I demoted you." "Like Pluto? What am I now?" A dwarf planet, I think." "Hey, I'm not that short." "Whatever, hold this wedge." I took one of the wooden wedges we just cut and held it against the crack between the runner and bedstones of our grain mill. Darla softly tapped the wedge in my hand with a hammer, barely inserting its tip between the stones. I picked up another wedge, and we worked our way around the mill, trying to pry the runner stone free with careful, even pressure. Darla had built this bicycle-powered grist mill not long after we arrived at the farm. In a bitter cold the night before, the stones had frozen together. Now we were trying to separate them without cracking the runner stone. Replacing it would take more than a week's labor. Holding wedges for Darla left a lot of time to think. We were planning a birthday party for my cousin Max that night. He was turning 13. Everyone but Aunt Carolyn and I had celebrated a birthday since I arrived on the farm. Darla had turned 18, 2 years older than I. Well, really just a year and a half. While Darla and I worked on the grist mill, Max, Anna, and Rebecca were in the greenhouses caring for our crop of kale. It was worth its weight in gold now. More, actually, since gold was almost worthless. You couldn't eat gold or build anything useful with it, after all. Kale, by contrast, would grow even if the temperature in the greenhouses got close to freezing. And kale has tons of vitamin C, the only cure for scurvy, which had become an epidemic since the eruption. When the weather had grown so cold that even the kale started to die, Darla designed a wood-fired heating system for the greenhouses. She found a description of a similar system, a hypocaust, in one of my cousin Anna's books, Built to Last. It had taken almost a month of back-breaking labor to build. A frozen dirt ramp led down to an enclosed, oven-like space where we built a fire every night. A metal door with a small air intake covered the fire shelf. Smoke and hot air from the fire flowed up into a winding series of ducts buried under all three greenhouses, eventually escaping at the far side. That way, the fire heated the ground under our kale without filling the greenhouses with smoke. On the downside, we had to keep the fire outside the greenhouses burning every night. So we had to cut more wood. Luckily, my uncle's farm backed up against Apple River Canyon State Park. We never would have cut its trees in normal times, but now we had no choice. That's where Uncle Paul and Aunt Carolyn had gone that day, to the edge of the leafless forest to cut firewood. Darla said they were going out there to get some alone time, but that didn't seem likely to me. It was way too cold to expose any more skin than you absolutely had to. A crack of gunfire brought me crashing back to earth. Darla froze and locked eyes with me. Then we heard Anna scream. Darla dropped her hammer and we dashed to the side door of the barn, the one that faced the greenhouses. I eased it ajar and peered out. Four men wearing ski masks and ragged forest camouflage were clustered around the door to one of our greenhouses. Max lay face down, a wide arc of blood staining the snow beside him. One of the men was prodding Max with his toe, his handgun trained on Max's head. A man wearing a bright blue scarf had Anna on the ground, his knee in the small of her back. He was tying a gag around her head. The third seemed to be supervising everything, holding a shotgun at the ready. The last had a machine pistol trained on Rebecca. Even from a distance, I could see her shaking. I held my clenched fists against my roiling stomach, as if to hold it in, to hold myself together. Max, was he dead? He wasn't moving. I'm going for help, Darla said, and she was gone, racing for the main barn door, which faced away from the greenhouses. Get it together, Alex, I told myself. Darla's getting help. Maybe there's something you can do in the meantime. The bandits were preoccupied with their task. None of them were looking my way. I opened the side door wider, dropped to my belly, and slithered through. Immediately I wormed off the trodden path into the deep snow. The snow slowed me down, but it also hid me. When I thought I was close, I cautiously raised my head above the level of the snow. The bandits had a homemade toboggan laden with lumpy canvas bags. They'd gagged and bound Anna and Rebecca, stacking them on the toboggan like cordwood. Machine Pistol was leaving one of the greenhouses with a plastic sack overflowing with kale. He'd harvested it so fast that he'd pulled up the roots. Blue Scarf stepped over to Max's body, hefted it, and tossed it on top of the load. Blood pulsed from Max's temple. I blinked repeatedly, but my eyelids couldn't clear the gruesome scene. My body was coiled tight, caught on the knife edge between two fears. I needed to help Max to see if he was even alive, but I couldn't move, couldn't approach the sled without being seen. The four bandits grabbed a knotted rope and started hauling the toboggan away. Max's blood drew an erratic pink streak in the snow. I couldn't let them abduct my sister and cousins. Rebecca was the only family I had left. I'd rather die than lie there in the snow and watch her being taken. I had a black belt in Taekwondo. I'd been forced to use it during my flight from Iowa last year, but trying to fight four of them at once Suicide. Suddenly it struck me. All I had to do was slow them down until Darla came with help. If I could get them to talk... I stood up. Stop! I shouted. All four of them turned. Three gun barrels swiveled toward me. I sent fruitless orders to my knees to be still. Leave the girls. Take me instead. I was relieved my voice didn't quaver. Much. Handgun stalked toward me until he was less than 30 feet away. His mouth twisted in a cruel leer, and he raised his gun, aiming at my head. Chapter 2. I was dead. He was too far away for me to rush him, too close for the bullet to miss. Trying to talk was a stupid idea, the last stupid decision I'd get to make. A gun barked. Handgun was thrown sideways, arms splayed as blood bloomed at the side of his chest. I glanced left. Darla was about 100 feet off, kneeling in the snow, her eye sighting down the length of Uncle Paul's hunting rifle. Shotgun raised his weapon, business end pointed at me. Max, who I'd feared was dead, punched at the bandit, aiming for his groin. He missed, hitting shotgun in the hip. The gun wavered and boomed. My side felt like it had been stung by a dozen angry hornets, although most of the pellets flew wide, peppering the snow beside me. Another shot rang out. The bullet caught shotgun square in the chest and threw him backward against the toboggan. I was running forward without ever having made a conscious decision to charge. I had to get to machine pistol before he started spraying bullets everywhere. Blue Scarf turned and ran. Machine pistol hesitated, then stepped backward and raised his gun at me. Darla shot again but missed. I put everything I had into my insane charge, screaming at the top of my lungs. Maybe he'd just shoot me instead of spraying Max and the girls. Instead, he lowered his gun and fled. Darla fired again. Machine pistol stumbled, but collected himself and kept running. I staggered to Max, my body trembling with fear and adrenaline. A bullet had carved a narrow trough along his temple. Blood soaked the side of his hat, scarves, and coat. "Get the hell out of my field of fire!" Darla screamed. I ducked, hoping she could fire past both of us. Bright red blood poured from Max's head, gushing in time with his heartbeat. I hesitated a moment, unsure what to do. A year ago, I would have screamed for help and called 911. Now, nobody but Darla would hear me scream. The phone wouldn't work, and even if it did, there was no one to answer it. I knew how to stop the bleeding, put a clean cloth over it, and apply pressure. But what if his skull were cracked? Wouldn't pushing on it make it worse? Maybe kill him? I stripped off my gloves and started probing the wound as gently as I could with my fingertips. Max moaned. He was shaking and sweating despite the cold. My hands dripped blood. Darla was alongside the shed now, kneeling in the snow and firing at the fleeing bandits. Max's temple was firm under my fingertips, which I hoped meant his skull wasn't broken. I ripped off one of my scarves and pressed it against his head. "They're in the South Hollow, running like wild rabbits," Darla said as she lifted the rifle and stood. She took the knife off her belt and started cutting Rebecca and Anna free. "This wound is going to have to be sewn up," I told her. "I can do it," Darla said. She'd stitched up a vicious wound in my side last year. "I think we should get Dr. McCarthy. What if he's got a concussion or a break I didn't find?" "Okay," she replied. "Rebecca," I asked, "you okay?" She didn't look okay. She was trembling and rubbing her wrists. "Not really," she said. "What should I do?" "Can you run to the woods and get Aunt Carolyn and Uncle Paul?" She took a deep breath. "I'll be right back." She took two tentative steps towards the house and then changed directions, sprinting for the woods. Max's blood had already soaked through my scarf. Darla handed me one of hers, and I wrapped it around his head as tightly as I could. Anna was crouched with her hands covering her inner thighs. I saw a spot of wetness around one of her hands. "Anna," I said softly, "it's okay. I peed myself the first time I met bandits last year."
"You did?"
"Yeah, I did." It wasn't true. I'd thrown up, but I needed Anna's help. "Can you take care of your brother while Darla and I get Dr. McCarthy?" Anna nodded. Your mom and dad will be back soon. Tell them we've gone to get the doctor, and we'll be right back, okay? She nodded again. I tied the second scarf around Max's head, and we carried him into the house and laid him on the floor by the living room fireplace. I grabbed a couple of spare scarves while Darla told Anna how to care for Max. As we ran toward the barn, I passed one scarf to Darla and wrapped the other one around my neck. It was one of Aunt Carolyn's, bright orange-red and not particularly warm. Better than nothing. We threw open the barn doors and dragged out Bikezilla. That's what I dubbed Darla's snowmobile. She'd built it not long after she finished the grist mill. The snowmobile was a tandem bike frame with a ski attached to the front fork where the tire had been. Darla had scavenged a track off a real snowmobile and installed it in place of the bicycle's rear wheel. Above that, she built a small wooden load bed, almost like a pickup truck's. A real snowmobile would have been a lot faster, but we couldn't get gas. The meager amount still stored in the tanks at Warren's only gas station was reserved for emergencies. We'd been using Bikezilla for the past 6 months to haul kale to Warren to trade for pork. Warren had thousands of frozen hog carcasses stored, since there were several slaughterhouses nearby. Bikezilla wasn't as fast as a real bicycle, but it could handle deep snow okay, and the load bed could carry plenty of pork. On the icy road to Warren, it was at least twice as fast as running. Darla and I stood up on the bike for the whole trip, kicking the pedals down. We had no extra breath for talking. My side hurt where the shotgun pellets had hit, and I felt a warm spot of blood soaking into my t-shirt. I gritted my teeth and ignored it. Darla and I slid up to the clinic, beating our previous best time to Warren by 5 or 6 minutes. I could tell Dr. McCarthy was in because I saw his 41 Studebaker Champion parked around back. We charged into the small, one-story clinic. Dr. McCarthy was in an exam room, chatting with a patient by the light of an oil lamp. When I told him what was wrong, he got his assistant to take over. "You want to ride along?" he asked. "No," I said. "We'll ride back. I don't want to leave Bikezilla." I didn't think it would get stolen in Warren, but I didn't want to take that chance either. By the time we got back to the farm, Dr. McCarthy was almost done stitching up Max. Aunt Carolyn was assisting him. The injured side of Max's head had been shaved. He was biting down on a leather-wrapped stick since Dr. McCarthy had run out of painkillers months ago. I wondered if it was the same stick that Uncle Paul had bitten when Dr. McCarthy had set his broken leg the year before. The leather was scarred by dozens of bite marks. "He okay?" I asked. "Seems to be," Aunt Carolyn answered. Dr. McCarthy was concentrating on his stitches. "He might be concussed. Although with Max, how would you know if his brains were scrambled?" She was smiling as she said it, but unbidden tears spilled from her eyes. "Maybe instead of scrambling his brains, the bullet knocked them back into working order," I said. "I'm still here," Max grunted through clenched teeth. "I know you are, honey." The gratitude in Aunt Carolyn's voice was palpable. "A leather-wrapped stick is a pretty crappy birthday present," I said. Max grunted. I couldn't tell if he was agreeing or just annoyed at my lame joke. Aunt Carolyn broke the short silence. "Max said you just walked up to those bandits, Alex." "Pretty much." "That was stupid." "Yeah, but I knew Darla was getting help. I'm just lucky she decided to get the rifle instead of going to get you guys." Dr. McCarthy tied off the last stitch in Max's head. "Hey, Doc, can you take a look at my side?" I asked. "What's wrong with your side?" Darla said. "Well, that shotgun. You got hit, and you didn't tell me?" She was practically yelling. "I thought you could tell from the holes in my coat." "Shut up. Your clothing's so ragged, nobody would notice a few extra holes. And we rode all the way to... Lie down on that couch right now, you jerk." I obeyed. When Darla was that angry, doing anything else was insane. She started stripping my clothing, muttering all the while. "Stupid, pig-headed, obstinate, obnoxious, oviparous, egg-sucking boy." I both laid and sucked eggs? That didn't make sense. Whatever. Most of the shotgun pellets hadn't penetrated my 5 layers of clothing. I had 8 or 9 purplish bruises and 3 blood-encrusted holes on the side of my belly. All three holes were below the huge, horseshoe-shaped scar where Darla had stitched up the hatchet wound a prison escapee named Target had inflicted on me the year before. "What, are you collecting scars on that side of your body?" Darla said. "I guess." "Well, quit. The spot I stitched up is enough." "That's a pretty rough-looking patch job," Dr. McCarthy commented. Darla scowled. "Like to see you do better with an old sewing needle." "I probably couldn't." Dr. McCarthy took the leather wrap stick from Max, wiped it on a cloth, and gave it to me to bite. He dropped a scalpel and a scissor-like pair of tongs he called a hemostat into a pan of boiling water over the living room fire. While we waited for his tools to be sterilized, he gently wiped away the dried blood on my side. When he slit the side of the first wound, it didn't hurt much. But then he started digging around in the hole. Tears leaked from my eyes. When he got the hemostat clamped on the pellet and pulled it free, I just about launched off the couch to slug him. Darla grabbed my hand, and I clung to her, trying not to move. Then we had to repeat the whole procedure, twice. Dr. McCarthy didn't stitch up the holes. He just put a bandage over them and taped it in place. "Guess you all get a bulk discount today." "I guess," Aunt Carolyn sighed. "I'll get you some supplies." "Got any eggs?" "A few. Some goat meat, too." Aunt Carolyn stood up. "Where's everybody else?" Darla asked. "Out by the greenhouses," Aunt Carolyn answered. "I'll go see if Paul needs help," Darla said. "Let me get dressed," I said. "I'll come, too." "You need to rest," Darla said. "If I can bike all the way to Warren with three shotgun pellets in my side, I can walk to the greenhouses without them." "Tell him to rest, would you please?" Darla begged Dr. McCarthy. "He won't listen to me anyway. Just stay with him and don't let him do any heavy lifting for a couple days." Darla scowled, but she got a clean T-shirt out of a basket in the corner of the room and tossed it at me. As we approached the greenhouses, I saw Rebecca's and Anna's silhouettes moving around inside. Uncle Paul was bent over the toboggan, sorting through the bandit supplies. "Did you find the shotgun?" I asked. "Shotgun?" Uncle Paul said. "One of them had a little .22 pistol in his hand." I pointed at the other corpse lying in the snow. "He had a shotgun." I walked over to the body. A huge red stain had spread from the hole in the guy's chest to the surrounding snow, and the blood had already started to freeze. I looked around. Sure enough, there was a long depression in a snowdrift on the far side of the toboggan. The shotgun must have flown out of his hands and buried itself in the snow when Darla shot him. I pulled the shotgun free and wiped the snow off it with my shirt tail. Someone had painted four tiny blue flowers on the wooden stock. They seemed incongruous, too delicate to decorate a weapon of war. Amid the flowers, two words were drawn in fancy script. Blue Betsy. "Weird," I said to Darla. "Who decorates their shotgun with flowers?" Darla shrugged. "Decorates? With flowers?" Uncle Paul said. "Blue flowers? Let me see." I passed the shotgun to him. "What is it?" "Remember I told you I traded a pair of goats for a shotgun and gave it to your dad? And he took it with him when he left here last year?" "Yeah," I said. "This is it, Alex. The shotgun he took when he left for Iowa last fall. When he went to search for you." Chapter 3. I collapsed into the snowbank. Not a good idea when it's below zero. But I didn't notice the cold. I was too numb. "You okay?" Uncle Paul asked. "I guess," I said. "Give us a minute," Darla said as she sat down in the snow beside me. Uncle Paul nodded. "I'm going to help Rebecca and Anna replant the kale those bastards pulled up," he mumbled as he shuffled off. Darla turned to me. "You okay?" "What does it mean? Is Dad dead? Why else would this guy have his shotgun?" I punched at a clump of snow. "I don't know. Maybe Dad sold it, or traded it for something. He could be alive, right?" "Yeah, he could." We sat in silence. After a while, Darla asked, Why'd you stand up in front of those guys? I was trying to talk to them, to delay them. In the rush to take care of Max and get Dr. McCarthy, I hadn't really thought about the fight. You saved my life again. Yeah, what's that now, 47 times? Darla shrugged. Just about. You have a serious talent for needing to be saved. I guess. Thanks. Trying to talk to those guys was stupid. I wasn't ready to shoot yet. I couldn't let him walk off with the kids, and you got ready in time. Darla grabbed my collar, pulling me closer and yelling in my face. Yeah, but Christ, you scared me. What if I'd missed? You do anything that idiotic again, and I'll shoot you myself to save the heartache of watching someone else do it. Sorry. I hadn't really been thinking too clearly. Obviously. But still. And I still don't get why the guy with the machine pistol didn't perforate your sad hide. He was unnerved by my crazy taekwondo charge? I forced a smile. Darla glared. You have a death wish or something? No. Crappy as this world is, I don't want to leave it. I reached out and squeezed her hand. Don't want to leave you. Suddenly, she rolled on top of me, yanking our scarves out of the way and kissing me. Darla pressed her body into mine, burying me in the snow. Her weight, slight though it was, hurt my side. I ignored the pain, wrapping my arms around her and trying to keep up. The kiss lasted for a dizzying minute. When she came up for air, she said, "Don't you ever do something like that again." If it gets me another kiss like that, I might. Darla slugged my shoulder hard enough to bruise. "Got it," I said. "Shouldn't we be helping Uncle Paul?" Darla stood, offered me her hand, and pulled me up. We made our way through the two plastic doors that formed an airlock for the greenhouse. It was relatively warm in there, which was good. I was freezing after being half buried in snow by Darla. Most of the kale had come out of the soft, moist greenhouse soil with its roots intact so we could replant it. When we found a plant with badly damaged roots, we harvested the leaves, saving the stems and roots for the goats. "Will the kale regrow?" I asked Uncle Paul as the five of us walked back toward the house. "I think most of it will be okay." He laid a hand on my shoulder. "You sure you're okay?" "Yeah." I thought for a moment, picking my next words carefully. "I'm going to leave. To look for Mom and Dad." I glanced at Darla and was relieved to see her nod. "How will you find them?" Uncle Paul asked. "I'll track down the two bandits who got away." "They aren't going to volunteer the info you want just because you asked them to," Uncle Paul said. "We'll bring guns," Darla replied dryly. "Those are pretty convincing." There was a long pause in the conversation as we approached the house. Eventually, Uncle Paul nodded. "I'll start sorting out supplies for you. You'll want to get moving at first light so they don't get too far ahead." I held the storm door for my uncle and Darla. "Maybe we should leave now." "Better if you get a good night's sleep. They won't be traveling tonight either. Their torches are still on the toboggan." The scene inside the house was positively tranquil after all the craziness of the day. Dr. McCarthy was gone. Aunt Carolyn was sitting on the floor beside Max, holding a cup of water to his lips while Rebecca stirred a bowl of corn porridge. "What's this about traveling?" Aunt Carolyn said to Uncle Paul. "How's Max?" Uncle Paul asked. "He's fine. Tell me what you're talking about." "Alex and Darla are leaving in the morning." Uncle Paul frowned. "One of those bandits had Blue Betsy." "What? No." Aunt Carolyn sloshed water across Max's face, and he spluttered. "There's no way we can keep up with all the work without Alex and Darla. And what if we get attacked again? What if they attack the house next time?" "We'll have to manage," Uncle Paul replied. "We can board up all the windows on the ground floor. Put bars on the doors, too." "Your leg isn't completely healed from the fall, and..." "I've been off the crutches for more than a month, hun," Uncle Paul said, clearly exasperated. "I know, but you're still limping." "Not much. The muscles are weak, that's all. It's getting better." "They're still kids. We can't let them going running around in this mess. They'll get killed." "I'm 18. Darla folded her arms over her chest. And Alex isn't a kid anymore, whatever his age. Why do you guys keep talking about Alex and Darla? Rebecca said. I'm going too. She folded her arms, mimicking Darla so closely that it might have been funny, except for her grim expression. Rebecca, no, I said, as gently as I could manage. She turned on me. You think it was fun, waiting for you last year? Thinking you were dead? And then Mom and Dad left, and I thought I'd lost everyone, my whole family, gone. I'm not going to go through that again. I know it's hard, I said, but Aunt Carolyn is right. She and Uncle Paul need help. Darla and I wouldn't be leaving now except for that shotgun. Darla can stay. They're not her parents. I'm going, Darla said flatly. Then I am too, Rebecca said, although she sounded far less certain than Darla. I shook my head, scowling. I understood how she felt. I didn't like being treated like a kid, and really, none of us were kids anymore. We spent our time struggling to survive, not going to school or playing games. But if she got hurt, or God forbid killed, looking for our parents, I'd never forgive myself. Rebecca looked down and whispered, I don't want to be alone again. I know. I pulled her into a hug. But you won't be alone. You'll take care of Max and Anna and help your aunt and uncle. Yeah, she murmured, holding on to me. But you better come back. You and Darla had best get some sleep, Uncle Paul said. Carolyn and I will get your packs ready. I'll wake you before dawn. I let go of Rebecca, and Darla took my hand, pulling me toward the kitchen. Let's get washed up. That night, I lay awake in bed for more than an hour. Darla was on one side of me, Rebecca, Max, and Anna on the other. My aunt and uncle still hadn't come to bed. The kids called out or moaned occasionally in their sleep. Nightmares, I assumed. From her breathing, I could tell Darla wasn't sleeping either. I put an arm over her shoulder and hugged her closer. You okay? I whispered. Her body heaved and she choked back a sob. It's okay, I whispered. Shh, you don't have to be tough all the time. I never killed anyone before. I know, I stroked her back. It's not like killing a rabbit or a pig. No. Does it get better? I thought about Ferret and Target, bandits I'd killed during our escape from Iowa last year. They still occasionally starred in my own nightmares. No. Darla snuggled against my shoulder. I couldn't hear her crying, but I felt the tears washing my neck. It was a long time before she fell asleep. My side ached and my thoughts raced. I stared into the darkness, thinking about my trip from Cedar Falls last year, about all the people who'd helped me during my journey. My thoughts turned to Mom and Dad. I couldn't call up a clear picture of either of them. I mean, I knew what they looked like, but the images were blurry. I lay awake, struggling to remember my parents' faces, until Uncle Paul called me in the grayness just before the dawn. Chapter 4. We ate a huge breakfast. Duck eggs scrambled with kale from our farm and ham we'd gotten in trade from Warren. Everyone was silent, like they had so much to say they couldn't decide where to start. It made me uncomfortable, so I wolfed my food and excused myself. Buckzilla's load bed was packed with bags and bundles. Darla untied the ropes holding down the load and started poking through it. I packed everything you'll need, Uncle Paul said. Doesn't hurt to check, Darla replied. The pistol and the shotgun, Blue Betsy, were there along with a box of shells. I was a little surprised. That gun, with the extra ammo, was worth a fortune. People everywhere were hoarding weapons, so their value had skyrocketed since the eruption. By now, the shotgun and shells were probably worth as much as a small herd of goats or a flock of egg-laying ducks. The shotgun wasn't the most valuable thing Uncle Paul had given us, though. 20 small envelopes made from pages of an old Dan Brown novel were tucked into a cloth pouch. Each envelope contained 200 carefully counted kale seeds. One packet like these had been enough to buy the snowmobile, tandem bike, and a welding rig in Warren. If, before the eruption, somebody had handed me a briefcase stuffed with $100 bills, it would have been about this valuable. I stared at the bundle, shocked into silence. Darla tilted her head toward Uncle Paul. "You sure?" He nodded. "I saved enough for a safety margin, and we'll let a third of the next crop go to seed. We'll be okay."
"I don't know what to say," Darla said.
"You and Alex may not be married, and he may not be my son, but we're all family. You too. We take care of our own." Darla's eyes shone in the dawn light as she turned away. Uncle Paul pulled her into a rough hug. "You come back. Find my brother and his wife, if they're alive. And bring that boy home, too."
"I will," she said. "I will."
"I'm right here," I said, "and I'll bring myself home." Darla and Uncle Paul looked at me in the exact same way. "Yeah, right," their faces said. I decided to change the subject. The pistol the bandit had used to shoot Max lay amid the bundles on Bikezilla's bed. I picked it up. "How's this work?"
"I'm amazed it works at all," Uncle Paul said. "I stripped it down and oiled it, but it's a piece of junk, a Saturday night special."
"You test fire it?" Darla asked.
"Nope. There's only one magazine with 4 bullets. I could get more .22 pistol ammo in Warren, maybe, but I don't have any here."
"We should try it anyway," Darla said. "Better to have 3 bullets we know work than 4 we're not sure of."
"It worked on Max's head yesterday. Wish it hadn't. But go ahead if you want."
"I've never fired anything but a rifle or shotgun," Darla said as she took the pistol from me.
"It's a semi-automatic," Uncle Paul said. "Safety's on the side. Rack the slide to chamber around." Darla clicked the safety to fire, pulled the slide on top of the weapon toward her, and released it. She held the pistol in a 2-handed grip and aimed at a patch of snow about 10 yards off. She squeezed the trigger, and I put my hand over my ears, expecting a bang. But the gun just clicked. Darla looked at Uncle Paul.
"Misfire," he said. "I was afraid of that. The ammo looked old."
Darla tried to squeeze the trigger again, but nothing happened. "Rack the slide to eject the dud." Darla ejected the bullet, aimed, and squeezed the trigger again. Pop! It wasn't much of a noise, even for such a small gun. A spray of snow kicked into the air where the bullet struck.
"Well, 2 bullets left, which might or might not actually fire. You may as well keep it."
She thumbed the safety on and handed it butt first to Uncle Paul.
"No, you keep it. Maybe you'll be able to trade it for something, or buy some decent ammo."
Darla started repacking. In addition to the guns, Uncle Paul had given us a huge supply of cornmeal and dried pork, a tent, a large sleeping bag, extra blankets, extra clothing, a coil of rope, 2 pots, 4 water jugs, 2 spoons, a medical kit, old road maps of Illinois and Iowa, a small pair of binoculars, a lamp with an extra bottle of oil, a couple of homemade candles, and a fire-starting kit with a chunk of flint and a mess of dry, shredded oak bark. I had a hatchet and a 5-inch Bowie knife on my belt. I carried the jongbong, or staff, I'd made not long after I'd reached the farm 8 months ago. The staff had always been one of my favorite taekwondo weapons. I snagged the package of kale seeds and tucked it into the inside pocket of my coat, against my chest. Darla slid both guns and my staff under the ropes on top of the load so we could get at them in a hurry if we needed to. Then we said our goodbyes. I hugged everyone in turn, my aunt, uncle, and sister. I said goodbye to my cousins Max and Anna earlier. Max was still too woozy to get up, and Anna was keeping an eye on him. By this time, I was itching to get moving. I straddled the bike's back seat. I figured Darla should be in front because she'd be better at spotting the trail than I would. Plus, the view was better from the back seat of Bikezilla. Not that there was much to look at. Darla was wearing heavy winter coveralls, and her luscious dark hair was wrapped in hats and scarves. But still. The biggest problem with Bikezilla was getting it started. Darla and I had to stand on the pedal, straining against our handlebars just to get it inching forward. Once we got it going, though, we sailed across the snow. I glanced back. My family had receded to tiny figures, indistinguishable from each other. They were already dispersing to start their morning chores. The land around us was low, rolling hills, suffocated under the never-ending burden of ash and snow. Occasionally, the sad remnant of a tree protruded from the snow, its branches broken and leafless. Darla clicked into a higher gear, and we sat down, settling into a ground-eating pace. My side hurt, but I ignored the pain as best I could, and soon it dwindled to a numb ache. I thought we'd have to move slowly to track the bandits, but if anything, Darla was speeding up. I craned my neck to peer around her and figured out why. The bandits had left a trail of trampled snow heading roughly south across the fields. Every 30 or 40 feet, a few drops of blood stained the snow, easy to see against the nearly featureless white expanse. We raced along the trail for a half hour or so before it intersected a 12-foot-high snowbank that ran north and south as far as I could see. Darla stopped Bikezilla beside it. Deep leg holes had been punched into the snow. Our two bandits had struggled across the bank directly in front of us. One of them had been leaking blood, staining the snow pink. I stood on the pedals, trying to get enough height to see over the berm. Can't see over. Scouted on foot? Yeah, I guess so. We dismounted Bikezilla and clambered over the snow berm. On the other side, there was a road, plowed but not salted. A fine dusting of snow blew over the icy surface the plow had left. It looked little used, which wasn't surprising. Nobody but FEMA had much gas anymore. Keeping the roads clear was about the only useful thing that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, was doing. They were often more of a danger than a help to survivors. "Well, they didn't cross here," Darla said as she inspected the far side of the road. Between the packed surface and blowing snow, no footprints were visible anymore. Figuring they'd probably keep going in the same general direction, I wandered south. About 50 feet down the road, a drop of blood stained the snow. I turned and discovered that Darla had been following me. "They're heading south, away from Warren. How are we going to get Bikezilla across that mountain of snow?" I asked as we walked back to the bike. "Get up some speed and jump it, maybe?" "Jump it?" It sounded more like a formula for a wreck than a plan. "Yeah, sure. Didn't you ever watch snowmobile races on TV?"
No.
"You're weird. Snowmobile races are the best."
"Were, anyway."
Her voice sounded uncharacteristically nostalgic. "If you say so." I climbed onto Bikezilla's back seat. We strained to get the bike moving, and Darla steered us in a wide arc until we were lined up perpendicular to the snowbank. She shifted into a higher gear and stood up on the pedals. I stood, too, pounding my legs down, trying to put on as much speed as possible. As we flew up to the berm, Darla yelled, "Hold on!" Bikezilla tilted backward, and my stomach lurched as the front ski started to climb. Then it caught in a nearly vertical wall of snow, and the back end of the bike kicked up, throwing me over the handlebars and into Darla. We face-planted into the embankment in a jumble of arms and legs. Chapter 5. Bikezilla fell sideways behind us and slid partway back down the slope. I lifted my head out of the snow and grabbed Darla's arm. "You okay?" She looked dazed for a moment. Then she grinned.
"Wicked! Let's do it again!"
I vetoed that idea. But that meant I had to listen to Darla grumble for the next 15 minutes while we struggled to drag Bikezilla across the berm. The snow was so deep that some of it got under my jacket and into the legs of my coveralls. I checked the load bed. Everything was secure, but the guns were wet, so we spent some time cleaning them. By the time we started out again, I was chilled through. We made good time across the fields, but on the packed snow of the road, we flew. Within moments, I was shivering. The wind didn't help. I thought about stopping to change clothes, but figured the exertion of pedaling would keep me warm enough until I dried. Every few 100 feet, we passed another spot of blood. The bandits were moving faster, too. We raced past 2 abandoned farmsteads. Plowed snow completely blocked both their driveways. Most of their outbuildings and barns had collapsed under the weight of the ash and snow. The third farmstead we came to was different. Enough people had trudged across the berm to make a path where the driveway used to be. And someone had brushed against the snowbank, leaving a pink streak. Darla pulled Bikezilla up beside the snowbank, where it would be hidden from the house. She slid the shotgun out from under the ropes and tried to pass it to me.
"No, you take it," I whispered. I took my staff and the pistol instead, tucking the gun into my belt.
"You ready?" Darla nodded. I crawled into the driveway, moving slowly and dragging my staff along. As soon as I had a clear view of the house and yard, I stopped. The path continued to the front door of the small, ranch-style home. Two grain silos, a barn, and two other outbuildings were arrayed in a rough semicircle behind the house. Except for the tracks leading to the front door, the farm looked abandoned. I whispered to Darla, "Come up to the edge of the snowbank and cover me from there. I'll run to the house. If I make it, you follow." I waited until Darla squeezed in beside me with the shotgun. Then I took the pistol in one hand and my staff in the other and scuttled towards the house in a walking crouch. The silence was eerie. My breath roared in my ears. I made it to the corner of the house and glanced around. Nothing moved. I waited. 30 seconds. A minute. Then beckoned for Darla to follow. We crept around the house, peeking in every window. Nothing stirred. The living room and kitchen were empty, but we couldn't see into the bedrooms. The windows were blocked by mini-blinds and curtains. We stopped by the side door, where we had a clear view of the driveway. Darla planted herself beside the door, the butt of the shotgun tucked against her side. I stood to one side, staying out of her field of fire. The door jamb was splintered. A smear of blood stained a knob. With one hand, I gently pushed open the door. It groaned hideously, revealing a small mudroom attached to the kitchen. I stepped through the doorway and pressed myself against the wall while Darla scouted the kitchen with the shotgun. The kitchen connected to the living room and a pitch-black interior hallway. The carpet was covered with clumps of snow and ash, some of which held crumbling boot prints. It smelled stale and musty, despite the frozen air.
"We aren't going to be able to see anything in that hall," I whispered. "You think anyone is here?" Darla whispered. "Might be asleep. They could have walked all night." "Maybe. Get the lantern?"
"Yeah. Cover the door for me." We left the house, and Darla stepped to one side of the door so she could shoot anyone coming out. I jogged back to Bikezilla to retrieve the lantern. Lighting it was a laborious and somewhat noisy process, so I did it beside the bike. I had to strike a spark into some of the oak bark using my knife and the flint, use that to light a candle, and then finally fire up the lantern with the candle. Before the volcano, I would never have guessed that matches and lighters would be among the things I'd miss most if civilization collapsed. With the pistol on my belt, lantern in one hand, and staff in the other, I jogged back, careful to zigzag just in case. We stalked back into the house. The hallway was empty, and all three doors at the far end of it were closed. We moved as quietly as we could, but even the whisper of my feet against the carpet sounded loud in my ears. I opened the first door. Darla beside me with the shotgun ready. The lamplight gleamed on porcelain. A bathroom. The toilet tank was broken, the water within frozen into a block of dirty ice. I stepped inside to peek behind the shower curtain. Empty. The second door led to a bedroom. The bed was a rumpled mess. Filthy clothes were piled in one corner, next to scattered splinters that might once have been a dresser. The room was otherwise empty. I opened the third and last door. The lantern revealed another unmade bed. The rest of the furniture had been reduced to broken scraps.
"Check the far side of the bed," Darla whispered.
I crept across the bedroom. Nobody was beside the bed. But as I turned to go, I noticed a bloodstain on the sheets. I swung the light in a big, slow circle, looking for more blood. And I found some, two droplets low on the closed closet door. I pointed at it. Darla nodded, and we tiptoed to the closet.
I grasped the knob, standing to one side, while Darla trained the shotgun on the center of the door. I yanked it open. A blonde man sat on the floor, his right side soaked in blood, wild blue eyes flicking up at us. The shelves in the closet bar were empty, but I noticed all that in passing. What really caught my attention was the machine pistol he had trained on Darla. Chapter 6. "Take it easy," I said, trying to pitch my voice low and calm. "No need for anyone to get hurt." "You know," Darla said, "if I pull this trigger, it'll turn you into bloody confetti." I glared at her out of the corner of my eye. That wasn't exactly the calm, rational tone I'd been going for. "This is a Mac-10. The guy's words were slurred, as if he were drunk or something. "Put all 30 rounds into you in less than 2 seconds. Back away." I held up my hands, clutching my staff in one and the lantern in the other. "It's okay. We're backing up." I took a slow step backward. "Chill." Darla hadn't moved, and she was glaring sidelong back at me. "Back up a step, Darla," I said, using as calm a voice as I could muster. Her mouth hardened to a line, but she did it, moving back a pace with the shotgun still trained on the bandit. He started to nod. His head drooped and his eyes closed. The Mac-10's barrel fell. When it touched his knee, he gave a start and snapped awake, the gun barrel twitching from Darla to me and back to Darla.
"Keep backing up," he growled.
I took another slow step backward, studying the guy. His right elbow was clamped against his side. His coat and pants shone with fresh blood in the lamplight. A small puddle had collected by his right hip. He could have shot me on the farm, but he hadn't. He'd run instead. Why? "What's your name?" I asked.
"Doesn't matter," he replied, almost whispering.
"Strange first name your parents gave you, Mr. Matter," Darla muttered. "You had me dead to rights back on the farm. Why didn't you shoot?"
"Was a lost cause. Can't be wasting ammo. Now get out of here."
"We need to know where the shotgun Darla's holding came from. Maybe we could trade. We could patch you up if you tell us about that shotgun."
"I can see the flensing knife on your hips, boy. Don't take me for no fool."
The gun sagged again, and he snapped it back to horizontal. "You're bleeding out. We could help you if you tell us what we want to know. You even know where the shotgun came from?"
"Course I do. Was Bill's."
His gun dipped again. "Where'd Bill get it?" He raised the gun again, training it on me.
"Get on out of here," he whispered, "or I'll drill you both."
"Okay, okay. Take it easy." I backed out of the bedroom. Darla kept pace with me, the shotgun trained on the guy all the way. Once we were in the hall, out of his line of sight, Darla hissed, "What now?" "What was that?" I whispered back. "Last night you were crying about killing two of them. Today you're ready to blow one of them away?" "Slum bitches had it coming. Just because I felt bad about shooting them doesn't mean it was wrong. They weren't taking Rebecca and Anna to the state fair, you know."
"Yeah, maybe so."
"So what now?" "Just wait and listen a sec." Everything was still for a minute. It was so quiet in the hall that I could hear Darla's soft breathing. Strange that such a quiet place was almost the scene of gunfire. The bullets could easily have shredded this silence, and Darla and me with it. I rested my hands on my knees, trying to stop their trembling. My side hurt, but I welcomed the pain. Welcome the aliveness of it. I heard a soft thump from the bedroom. I got down on my knees to peek around the door jamb, figuring the guy would probably expect me to be standing. I couldn't see anything in the darkness of the bedroom, so I thrust the lamp through the doorway. The guy had slumped sideways in the closet. The hand holding the Mac-10 was flung outward, resting on the carpet beside him. I stood and stepped quickly through the bedroom. When I got to the guy, I stepped on his wrist so he couldn't raise the gun. He didn't even wake up. Darla reached down and pried the MAC-10 from his fingers. She fiddled with it for a moment and pulled a rectangular piece off the bottom of the weapon.
Huh.
Check this out. She held the block of metal out toward me. I shrugged. What am I looking at?
The magazine, dummy. It's empty. Guy was out of bullets. That's why he didn't shoot you at the farm.
I can see why his buddy left him here. He was bleeding out, probably slowing his friend down. But why'd he leave him with the gun? It's valuable. And one without bullets? Useless for defense.
Darla shrugged.
I bent over the bandit. His skin was pale as snow, and his lips looked bruised. I put the back of my hand against his mouth. He was breathing. When I checked his pulse, though, I had trouble finding it. He's alive, but barely.
Let's melt some snow, Darla said. Maybe if we splash water in his face, he'll wake up enough for us to ask him about the shotgun again.
Should we try to stop the bleeding first? If he dies on us...
Then we won't find out anything. Yeah, I guess we should patch him up first.
Darla scowled. I didn't like the idea of helping this guy any more than she did. He and his buddies had shot Max, had tried to kidnap the girls for who knew what. But we had no good way to track the other guy, the one who'd worn a blue scarf, and I needed to know where this shotgun had come from. I yanked the guy out of the closet. Blood was still oozing from the wound at his side.
Get the med kit off by Xilla, would you? I asked.
Christ. I stripped the bandit to the waist while I waited for Darla to return. She had shot him low on his right side. The wound on his back was just a small puncture that had mostly quit bleeding, but the bullet had left a crater the size of a child's fist as it exited the front.
It's not like we have a lot of extra bandages to waste on this guy, Darla said when she returned with our first aid kit.
I took a clean cloth out of the box, wadded it, and packed it into the wound as tightly as I could.
He isn't going to make it, Darla said. He's lost too much blood already.
I didn't reply, instead starting to wrap his torso with an ace bandage. Darla shook her head in disgust, but knelt to help. When I pulled the ace bandage tight, the guy woke up and started mumbling. Something about, "Gun, gun, where's my gun?" His hands clenched and unclenched as he talked.
"Where'd Bill get the shotgun?" I asked him.
He kept mumbling, his voice dropping and his words becoming incoherent.
Darla slapped her palm over the wound and pushed down. "Where'd you get the shotgun?"
The guy moaned and batted at her hand, feebly trying to knock it away from the wound. Darla bore down harder, and suddenly his body went limp.
"Is he dead?" she asked.
I checked his breathing and pulse again.
No.
We lit a fire in the living room hearth and melted snow, but no amount of water splashed on the guy's face would wake him. Darla went outside, scouting for signs of blue scarf. When she stomped back into the living room, she said,
"That last guy with this loser isn't leaving a trail. He must have left here by the road. Maybe he kept going south, but as soon as he makes a turn, we'll lose him."
"He could have left hours ago."
"Yeah, I think it's a lost cause. Sorry, Alex."
"This guy's still alive. Maybe he'll recover."
"You want to hang around here and see if he wakes up?"
"No, that'll take too long. And he might die. Let's load him on Bikezilla and take him to a doctor." I lifted him by his shoulders and started jamming his arms into his shirt. Darla sighed and helped me dress him. Then she lifted the guy's ankles while I grabbed his shoulders. We dragged him out of the house and laid him in the snow beside Bikezilla.
"We can tie him to the load bed over the supplies," I said, as I repacked the first aid kit, lantern, and guns.
"You know where we are?"
"I think so." Darla took the Illinois road map out of its protective plastic folder and opened it.
"I think we've been biking south on 78. We should be near Stockton." She pointed at a dot on the map south of Warren.
"You know anything about Stockton? Is there a doctor there?"
"I don't know. It looks bigger than Warren on this map. We could probably make it back to Warren in a couple of hours. It's straight north on 78. Just take him to Doc McCarthy."
I looked over her shoulder at the map.
"Let's try Stockton. It's a lot closer. And I really don't want to bring a bandit into Warren if I can help it."
Darla shrugged.
We repacked all our gear and then laid the guy on his stomach over Bikezilla's load bed. Darla tied him down, leaving his arms and legs overhanging the sides. We mounted Bikezilla and started pedaling south along Route 78. Less than 10 minutes of travel brought us to a T in the road. We passed 3 metal sign supports that barely protruded from the snow, but someone had sawn the signs